I take notes, we don't do it.
So that's something we can give to Karen?
Yeah, I'll give it to Karen.
Great.
Basically, how'd you get into the realm of game?
By being born.
You were born, okay.
I think an actor.
We've just destroyed several rumors.
Which were?
Tell me how you got born first.
The usual way. No, I think that actors and directors both are born. It's not something that you learn. It's either an instinct that you have or that you don't. And I think probably I didn't really actively pursue it or wasn't really much aware of it until I did a reading of Casey at the Bat when I was, maybe 11, 12, something like that. And it just came very, very naturally and comfortably, and it gave a nice dramatic presence, and got lots of praise afterwards. And it wasn't enough to spur me on, because I didn't do another thing for probably years after that. But every time I ever did anything, it was just very, very satisfying to me. It was something that just kind of went down my core. And it was something I actually didn't really come to grips with and directly confront until I was probably mid-20s, late-20s, well after I'd been out of college and also had been very involved in theater for a long time. But it was just something that became increasingly obvious to me that the most important, fulfilling thing that I have ever done in my life has been performing. And I think that both of them, both acting and directing, come from the same core. Personally, I prefer to perform, because then I am only responsible to myself, and I'm not needing to get into every single actor's headspace and the characters that they're playing. It's just responsible for me alone and carrying my own creative juices as far as I can carry them.
Except for God, I mean the director.
Right.
I'm responsible to him too.
Right.
Or her.
Right.
You said you didn't get into really until you were in your mid-20s. What other things have you done besides being an actor and director? We think in terms of professions and careers and jobs and stuff like that.
When I'm not in the theater, I usually get involved in social service programs. And it's usually as an escape from the theater. It's like whenever I've needed to kind of clear my head of the insanity of the business, then I come up to Alaska, or in the past, came up to Alaska. Previously, I worked with the Alaska Federation of Natives and put together an educational career counseling program, which I had connections with your wife. And then pretty much that sort of thing.
So this is what, your third time up to Alaska? You graduated at AMU, didn't you?
Yeah, that was my fifth college, and it was kind of just finishing it off. And interestingly enough, I ran into the best director that I've ever seen and ever worked with at any level, amateur or professional, at AMU. And his name was Frank Brink. And I think I got more from him in the brief period of time I spent with him than anybody else. That, in fact, everybody else combined. In the theater, he's kind of my guru, and
have you kept in touch with him?
Yeah, he's a very, very creative man. I think he's a genius.
So, anyway, from AMU, you say you go back to the East Coast and act for a while, and then head back to Alaska.
Yeah. Immediately after AMU, or a year and a half after, I went outside. Got my MFA in directing. And worked in, professionally. I did some summer stock in the southeast, Kentucky. Worked in Minneapolis at the Guthrie Theater for a season. Did School for Scandal for PBS television on their Theater in America series. All this is on the Vita, so we'll hold it off of that.
Yeah, I'll just pull it from there. Yeah, it's quite an accomplishment, Guthrie.
It was a good experience. I was quite surprised in the emphasis there. And I think it's probably typical of American theater period. There was not as strong an emphasis on the performing as it was on the technical. And all stops were pulled on the technical. Like there was a pair of boots, I remember they did a production of Love's Labor's Lost, had a part in that as well. There was a scene that was about 2 minutes long, and they had boots, suede boots that went all the way up to the hips of the four men that were wearing when they were playing that particular scene. Very expensive, solid leather, and they were only seen on stage for that long. So costuming was just, you know, out of this world. It was incredible. You couldn't surpass it, I don't think, anywhere. They used the most authentic material that they could, and nobody in the audience, I think, would even know it, or maybe 1% would. Their sets were incredible. Props were amazing.
That's the way they'd started out, because yeah. I remember seeing Hamlet at the Guthrie in modern dress, and they were, when the soldiers walk across at the beginning and the end of the play, here they were, they'd gone up. The Minnesota National Guard didn't have modern enough weapons for them. They went out and got, this was when they were trying to, anyway, they got the most modern weapons they could from the walk across stage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. M16s.
Yeah, it was before the M16s. All the M16s were going to Nam was when that happened. It was just before that.
Yeah. Well, that was right around the beginning of the Guthrie, 1960.
Yeah. Yeah, this was 63. Uh-huh. 64.
Do you remember who played it?
No, I was in high school then. 62, 63. 63, 64, 65,
well,
I would go there once or twice a year as a
high school.
Where'd
you go to school?
Shattuck down in Fairmont. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but you say acting is basically
that's
ingrained
my, yeah.
part of your life.
That's my passion.
What are your other passions? Lesser passions.
Well, I guess maybe it ties in with the other side of my professional life, that when I am not performing, then I usually get involved in social service projects or things along that line. It seems like the job that I have here at the university is a very nice marriage of those two, because I'm putting together the Duma Theater Program, and that is something that is completely novel. It's a virgin territory, excuse expression. There is no such program, as far as I'm aware of, like it in the world. And that sort of thing really, really intrigued me when the position was offered to me. I was back in New York at the time, and had spoken with Mike Gaffney, and had previously been up here for that very brief stint with Duma Theater. And they were saying that they had gotten permanent funding and full funding for really getting this program off the ground. And I think that's just very, very exciting, because the number of things that it can achieve is, I don't think you can count them. Most importantly, the purpose of the theater is cultural retention. And I don't think that there's a better vehicle for cultural retention than a theater or some sort of performing art, because it causes the audience to really emotionally get involved in what's going on, kind of like what we talked about the other day. And when they can get emotionally be stimulated by something, then it's something that sticks with them and gives them warm thoughts and feelings as they reflect on the having experienced whatever it was that they saw. And since it's a brand new art form for the native cultures, it's also something that's exciting. It's innovative at the same time as we're using it for the purpose of cultural retention. It's not a traditional form of expression. And yet drama has certainly been very, very intricately mm-hmm. involved in all of the cultures, in every culture. Another thing that's exciting too is that since it has not been developed and there is no, this is how you do it, we can take any phase of theater, and that's okay. We can go even to the very beginning roots of theater, mm-hmm. Rituals and primitive societies, which really is, I think, the root of theater. And we can take any form that has occurred since then. It can be a traditional contemporary dramatic form. It can be something very ritualized. So I've pretty much decided over the past year that I've been here that what I'm focusing in on is my only common ingredient is that it must be carry the principles of drama, of dramatics. That's got to touch the human spirit. And as to how to do that, that's an infinite number of ways.
You mentioned Duma, and you've also mentioned working for AFN.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are Alaska Natives a particular interest, or is it just that you happen to do these two areas?
I was born outside of the country. I was born in Colombia and raised most of my life outside of the U.S. And I felt myself to be not connected to the mainstream of American life. And so when I came to the States, when I was a junior in high school, I didn't feel a part of anything. I felt like my parents' society is what I was raised in. And they were both American. But still, they were unique and individual people and quite removed from American society and mainstream American ways. So I think that I've always just automatically had kind of a warm feeling or maybe more of a comfortable relating feeling with other cultures.
Mm-hmm.
I've been certainly exposed to many more than, say, an average American who has never left the country. I think that's probably the reason that I've kind of gravitated to Native Alaskans, and I had an attraction even when I was a young child, and I don't know why. I had no idea how it came up. When I lived in Puerto Rico, I was 8 years old, and there was somebody who was from Alaska that was visiting my parents down there, and they were talking about Alaska, and I wanted to go up there that summer, and it kind of had always had that. Pardon me?
At least you were smart enough to go in the summer.
Right, right. Although I could have been crazy enough to go in the winter, because down there, of course, we didn't have any snow.
Mm-hmm.
The only time I ever saw snow was when it came on Christmas Day from New York in a plane, and they would dump a plane load of snow on the airport runway so that everybody in San Juan could come out and see what snow looked like.
When you lived in Colombia, you didn't have snow?
No.
I lived right on the
equator, 8,000 feet up, mm-hmm. but right on the equator, so the temperature never got above 90, never below 60,
mm-hmm.
and very, very dry. But I think that's the reason that I've kind of gravitated to both Alaska. It just has always been something kind of in me, an attraction, and nothing that I've identified. And being in Alaska, I felt most comfortable in working with Native programs.
Well, your interest in culture.
Mm-hmm.
Is that why you picked the dining room as a play then?
Yeah.
You described that as a cultural play.
Yeah, yeah. The play is about, in a brief sentence, it's about an anthropological study of one of the vanishing cultures that's really authentically American, the Northeastern Wasp. And
that's two sentences, go ahead. Both incomplete, but that's...
Oh, you can cut those out.
You know that I'll do that anyway, go ahead.
Absolutely. That's why I'm feeling very loose. Not going to think about how to be articulate.
But it's
about a culture and a culture lost, or a changing culture. No culture remains static.
Mm-hmm.
It's always going to change. That's almost by necessity. If a culture did stay the same, it would die.
Mm-hmm.
It would no longer be living. Anything living always changes.
Now, in the play itself, you were set. There's 60 characters that are on the play, and they have to be played by 8 different people, and this is the way you're producing this one, directing this one. But is it a chronological development, or is it, you say it doesn't trace the family, but how does it work?
It doesn't follow any kind of chronological order. It does have kind of a symbolic order. The play starts as if it were the morning of a day, and it kind of follows through a 12-hour period from morning until night. And so that's the only kind of chronological order, is just the presentation of the scenes and the time that the scenes take place. But each of the scenes, 18 of them, involves characters that are completely different from any other scene in the play. So it's not tracing a family unit or a unit of people, it's tracing instead of a society. Those scenes jump all over the place. There's some that are in the 1940s, nothing that's specifically identified within the script as being, this is 1935, this is 1965, this is 1938. It's just the way that I'm feeling like interpreting them.
There's a timelessness to it?
Yeah. Each one of them is a little time capsule in itself. There isn't really, and I haven't decided yet if this is important to the play or if it's good or bad playwriting. Actually, I'm dismissing it, and I'll let the audience worry about that one, because it really isn't important to the theme of the play.
When you refer to the audience, how is the audience going to respond to this play? It sounds, for lack of a better word, quite different from what has traditionally been presented in the theater in Alaska.
Yeah, I don't think that very many, many of the audience members are going to associate with this particular culture. Although bits and pieces of it, I think we can all relate to just in the rules of the family, not putting your elbows on the table and all the rules that the dining room holds. The dining room in the society really is symbolic of this is where the culture is passed on. This is where it's taught. Intelligent conversation takes place at the dining room table. This is where the values...
Eaten with a 3-year-old or 2-year-old at a time. Go ahead.
Yes, rules are passed on. But
pass on rules, not intelligence at that age.
Right. That's the reason I think the play that the author used the dining room as the setting versus the living room, because of the function of the dining room in that society, particularly in that society. So I don't know how many of the audience members are going to relate to it as having been brought up in the well-to-do, wealthy, kind of aristocratic class of the Northeastern Wasp. But the human emotions, the life experiences that these people go through are identical to everything that everybody who lives goes through. Conflicts, love relationships, love lost, trying to find one's own destiny, who am I, all of these things are universal. And in that respect, I think the audience here, the audience anywhere, will certainly relate to it. So they're going to be relating to it, this is certainly my hope, that they will relate to it dramatically. And that really is the key to the theater, is if you get sucked into it and just can empathize with these people, irregardless of whether you have come from that particular region of the country, or a member of that particular social class. That's what they were related to.
Now, the presentation, is the play strong enough that we're not going to get confused jumping around that different scenes?
I have not seen this play performed, produced. So, if my imagination serves me correctly, I think it will it'll work perfectly fine, because dramatically, each scene very logically follows the one that preceded. And so it builds very nicely. There's a good progression to it. As to whether how it works, whether the people can get involved in all of these different characters when it just constantly changes and they don't have a chance to warm up to a particular family or to a particular individual character that they can trace throughout a play, that remains to be seen. I would not have selected it if I didn't believe that it would work.
How does this compare to the closest thing recently presented on this campus, the center of the Spoon River Anthology? How does this compare to that, or the jumping around, for lack of a better?
Well, it seems like the Spoon River Anthology, there were certain characters that did repeat throughout the play. They kept coming back, and it was just a very large cast of people that were established somewhat at the beginning and traced through throughout. In this case, we never return to another family. It's not from a single town. It's not from a single location.
I understand that, but I'm just trying to think of a parallel that's been presented
here. I see.
That people can draw
the parallel. The parallel would be that Spoon River Anthology is a dramatic piece. The overall feeling that one gets from watching the play as it progresses is more and more involvement in these people. And in that respect, the drama is the same. It has the same sort of an effect. You will get more and more involved in the people from this particular culture. And the depth of the human emotion, the human spirit, which is what comes out in Spoon River Anthology as well. It's a very, very different type of play, technically and in construction. It's not at all like Spoon River Anthology, where it's just individual characters without any definable set. This is a, these are actual scenes that are taking place between people. It's not solo people telling their life history.
Oh, I understand that. I was just trying to think of something that had been presented in Fairbanks the last couple of years that did not follow the scene one, scene two, scene three traditional format.
Mm-hmm.
You know, complete acts and everything. Right. I know there's scenes, excuse me. You understand what I'm saying.
Right. This would not be, this would be somewhat similar in the same way to the shadow box that FDA put on. Did you happen to see that?
No, I missed that.
Because it involved like two or three different family units, and one scene would be one family unit, the next would be another, and they would mesh in between each other.
Who should come to this play?
Everybody. Everybody. I think it's a...
Are any old children going to like?
Yes, I think so. The characters range from, that are played by adult actors, range from 8-year-olds to 80-year-olds. There was a birthday party, for example, of six of the children of one particular family, and they're all having a very raucous birthday party. Children will, it's not a children's play, it's an adult play, and I wouldn't recommend that 8-year-olds come to the play, but I think that anybody from 15 on up would certainly appreciate it.
You selected this play.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, I had been looking for a play to do midwinter. This one being my second winter, but I'd only gone through one last year before the selection. And I've been told that people really get dumps around this time of year. So I was looking for something that would be contemporary. Mm-hmm. I was looking for something that had a nice touch of comedy. To raise one's spirits, but for me personally, I don't enjoy just straight out comedy without some sort of a message, a deeper meaning. And so that was a third important dimension that I was looking for. I was back in New York all summer and was reading through quite a few plays. It finally settled in on this other play that I still hope to direct perhaps next year. And it turned out that the rights were not available for the play. And I didn't find that out until I had returned to Alaska. The school year had started, and we got in touch with the agent. Discovering that I could not do that when I quickly started scanning through many of the other plays that I had bought. And read through Dining Room, it just jumped out at me. I couldn't figure out why I hadn't read this in the summer. It was one that I had been intrigued about just because of what I had heard about it. And so it was kind of a quick adjustment changing from the other play that I originally wanted to do to this one. And then the agent, I had called back to New York to make sure the Dining Room was available, and I spoke with somebody, it turned out, that I knew, the agent's assistant,
mm-hmm.
Or his, the agency that represented the playwright. And I talked to him first about this other play. And he said, oh, yeah, we can release that to you. And by this time I said, well, I think I've changed my mind. I no longer want to do that one after all. I found this out in the Dining Room. So it was kind of a last-minute decision, but I'm very pleased with the selection. I'm glad that it forced me into reading some more plays, because it is a good play.
On your cast,
mm-hmm.
What's the strength of your cast at this play?
I think that all of the actors are... In the audition process, I needed to search for people that were not necessarily type actors, like an ingenue or somebody who plays old age very well. I needed to find actors that were versatile enough to play a number of characters.
Mm-hmm.
The average number of characters played by the cast is 6. So I was really checking them out for this versatility, to see how adaptable they were, and also to how well I could relate to them in helping them change interpretation and so on. And I'm very pleased with the cast. They've fulfilled my hopes that they would be as adaptable as they have proven to be.
Sounds great. From what I've heard, your rehearsals are going quite well.
Uh-huh. Knock on wood, I can't ever...
One of your cast members was telling me how much it's demanding more of us than I've ever had on, but it's good.
Uh-huh. I suspect that I am probably demanding more from the actors than any... I know that some of the cast members have said this, but more than any director has ever required of them, because they have not been exposed to certain dimensions of performing that, to me, are very, very important. And so I think that they're finding the experience quite rewarding, also stressful.
It's always a trade-off.
Right.
Let's play What If for a second. I'm going to mention your favorite director. Back, I believe, is the man's name?
Frank Brink.
Brink, okay. You mentioned he's one of your guiding lights. Who is your favorite actor or actress that would be well-known? If people could identify. And if you could be in any play, our movie or whatever, play any role that's available for anything, what would they be? That's a two-parter.
Okay, first part.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna ask
I don't have any established favorite actor mm-hmm. or actress. I automatically gravitate to performers that, for each role, come up with a very, very distinct, identifiable character. Actors who are not playing themselves, if you will.
So in other words, John Wayne would not be the top of your list?
No. Now, people that play themselves, John Wayne, Paul Newman, kind of, for me, falls into the same boat.
Yes.
Although I think he's certainly much more refined and more versatile than mm-hmm. John Wayne. Maybe very good on expressing themselves and being very honest and credible. But for me, somebody who is truly a good actor should be able to completely shed that coat of the character that they're playing and create an entirely new individual every time that they perform a different role. All of us are completely unique people, and it shouldn't be just taking on somebody else's words and putting on a different physical suit of clothes mm-hmm. When you play another character, because what comes out really is from the inside. So I guess people that fall into that category that I do have respect for include Dustin Hoffman. Mental block. Who's the actress?
What does she play?
Complete mental block.
Meryl Streep,
sure. And since I have a mental block, cutting out Robert Duvall, I have a lot of respect for him, and it's growing respect after seeing him in Tender Mercies, compared to the great Santini, for example. Those were two people that were really contributing. Well, Sissy Spacek, I have a lot of respect for her sensitivity mm-hmm. and her honesty. It seems like still there is, I think she's a wonderful actress, but she doesn't have that versatility to make her, in my definition, a complete, a perfect actress, if you will. I very much enjoy what she does, but it does still seem to kind of all fall into one lump. I guess maybe for that reason I am attracted to character actors, because they do completely change who they are from one role to the other.
Doesn't the star system also prevent somebody from having the
blessing? Exactly, and that's one of my frustrations with the profession. That's one of the reasons I would guess that I am here versus New York right now. You get locked into a certain type, and unless you can get typed into a versatile character type because you were given enough opportunities early in your career, then you get locked in, and the more that you play certain types of roles, like who knows if John Wayne early on, if he did have adaptable skills, adaptable characterizations, but perhaps he did. But once you get locked in and over and over and over and over and over doing the same character, it locks in. And by nature, actors are conservative. We rely on previous roles unless we ourselves have enough experience to force ourselves out of that or we have a director who is insightful enough to be able to crack us away. But we like to cling to what works, and usually that's something we've developed in the past. My favorite role, that one also, there are so many, but something that allows me to explore those dimensions. I love Hamlet. I love Shakespeare. And Hamlet is the most complex role that I have ever seen. It's almost like from one word to another to another. There is a change in mood. See if I can, one of my audition pieces is the, oh, that this too solid flesh, and the first five.
Slings and arrows about which.
Yeah. The first five lines, first four lines, he goes through like three or four mood changes. The first one is him saying, I wish that I could die, in effect. Total depression. Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw and resolve itself into a tube. God. God, how weary, stale, flat. Love, as he loses himself, for example, in thinking about his father and admiring how wonderful he is, to realizing that he's dead, to hating his mother and her weakness for having married as quickly as she did. It's wonderful because it keeps your mind, it forces your mind to stay right on the edge of total spontaneity, as you have to flow from one mood to the next, to the next, to the next. And Shakespeare, and so many of Shakespeare's roles do require that of an actor too. And when you combine that with the beauty of the language, it offers a real challenge because you cannot get hung up on the words themselves. You can't get caught up into the beauty of the language, because otherwise you start getting preoccupied by it and stressing it, like an old thing I just did. You start, oh, that this too solid flesh, and you want to stress every single word instead of remembering the meaning behind it and letting the thought behind that, the awareness that you want to die. You're saying, I wish this flesh would just disintegrate. I want to die. And not worrying about the words.
What other roles would you like? That's
dramatic roles.
You prefer that to trying to be a comedian?
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, no. Comedians also are dramatic roles. The way that I approach a comedian role, and I've played some comic roles, is also as very genuine people. And they are just as complex as anybody else. I do not like to do shtick. Stand-up comedian role, or doing a Bob Hope role in a movie, where Bob Hope is using a movie as a medium for being a comedian. That I don't care for. But I think some of the funniest movies, or some of the funniest moments in comedy, are when people are playing them straight out. Airplane, for example, I think that's what caused Airplane to work as a movie, is that everybody was playing these total nonsense lines and situations seriously. That's my philosophy of comedy. That's very challenging. Comedy is extremely challenging because of the timing involved and the number of ways that you can approach it.
That's good.
It's a delicate balance.
No. Now, you say you like Shakespeare. Would you include any other people, any other works as your all-time, some of your all-time favorites?
I enjoy Tennessee Williams, Arthur Miller. Hi. Yeah, another...
We were talking about some of the great plays, some of your all-time favorites. What are your top ten?
Tennessee Williams, Arthur Miller. I like those types of plays.
What about non-American playwrights?
I like Pinter. Chekhov. I haven't done very much Chekhov. I like the moods of them, but not enough to really be strongly attracted to them. The same sort of thing with Strindberg and Ibsen and so on. I'm not that much into black theater or avant-garde stuff, they really have strong emotional dramatic impact, but I don't care for the nightmarish sensation that they like to create. More kind of the traditional approach.
Let me jump way back to what we talked about at the beginning, we were talking about tuning.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel a sense of accomplishment out of this, and why?
It's a very long-term project. Mm-hmm. It's like birthing, I would imagine, birthing a child, or the image that seemed to come most strongly to me when I came up here or was thinking about accepting the position was, since there is no artistic model or academic model to follow, I felt like I was being kind of shot up into outer space without a capsule and told, okay, create your own environment. And so the first thing I needed to do was just spin a web for my own little space station. And then from that begin to expand out more and more and more so I could finally develop this little world. And the first thing I needed to do was learn how to spin the web, which way to go, or where do I go with this. And so it really meant my having to really backtrack. I didn't want to use, since it is a long, I see it as a very long-term project, and certainly something that's very innovative in the world. I see a lot of accomplishment just in the short time that I've been here, but it is such a large project. Creating an art form, or taking a dramatic art form and creating unique usage of it, that's very complex. And so I've just begun to, I wouldn't even say scratch the surface, I've begun to define the surface. And I had to accept, when I first came, I was thinking I would accept the job for 1 year, quickly put the thing together, develop a couple of works, and head back to New York. And I've had to try to resolve within myself this conflict of my performing passion, which is really what is really my core, that's my ultimate, or on the other side, how to mesh that with being a professor or an administrator, a program creator, all of which are extremely exciting, but they don't give me that same thrill. So I'm still having to work through that. How can I patiently flow with this and see this thing through to the point of where it really reaches the place it should be, and still keep in touch with my artistic outlet, my primary artistic release.
Which is
performing.
You perform last summer in New York.
You always perform in New York, whether you have a role or not.
Oh,
and trying to find work, auditions and all of that. No, it's extremely difficult. New York is a base from which to find work. It's not necessarily a place where you get work to perform in New York itself. And I have gotten work out in New York. In fact, I was up for a role in Cincinnati, one that was creating real conflict for me on whether to accept this position or to go with that role. And as it turned out, I ended up deciding for that. But it was a difficult decision.
Cincinnati or Fairbanks? How do you compare the two?
Since I didn't go to Cincinnati, I guess I don't really have room to compare. I think, from what I understand, it gets really cold down there, doesn't it? And it's tropical up here?
More or less.
Uh-huh.
It was until yesterday.
Uh-huh.
Relatively speaking. Well, I thank you for your time.